This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last year, Charlotte saw a marked increase in the number of murders being committed here. It was the highest since the 1990s. A quarter of those murders were connected to domestic violence. In this first month of 2018, we've witnessed multiple murders, and each of them had a connection to domestic violence. District Attorney Spencer Merriweather says we're experiencing an epidemic. In fact, CMPD responds to about 100 domestic violence calls a day, about 35 to 40,000 each year. And so this hour, we examine what might be driving this trend and how Charlotte compares to other parts of the country and what help is available for victims of domestic violence. Sergeant Craig Varnum supervises CMPD's domestic violence unit. He is in our Spirit Square studio along with Karen Parker, CEO of Safe Alliance, which assists over 10,000 people every year throughout Mecklenburg County and Lake Norman. Welcome to you both. Good morning, Karen.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. And with us by phone is Ruth Glenn, President and CEO of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which describes itself as the voice of victims and survivors, a catalyst for changing society to have zero tolerance for domestic violence. Ruth Glenn joins us by phone from Denver, Colorado. Welcome, Ruth. Ruth, nice to have you with us. Thanks for getting up early.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can also watch us this morning on Facebook Live. Sergeant, is the fact that 25%, one quarter of the homicides that Charlotte experienced last year related to domestic violence, a relatively new development, or has that been going on for years and years and years?
Well, certainly the overall numbers that you mentioned, the calls for service remain pretty constant and have done so over the past decade. The percentage of overall homicides this year that had a overall DV nexus is slightly higher than that proportion in previous years. But again, it was consistent with the overall rise in homicide rates.
And I'm assuming, Ruth, that you heard the numbers I threw out there. 25% of our domestic violence, of our murders last year were the result of domestic violence, and that the police department gets about 35,000 calls a year on this. How does that compare to what goes on in the rest of the country?
I think it's very comparable. Though there is a speak out there in regards to domestic violence decreasing, it certainly has not been our experience at the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence when you take a comparative look across the nation.
This used to be, and we've talked about this many years, I've been doing this show a long time, we talked about this early on in the history of this program as it used to be a dirty little secret that neighbors would pay no attention to, the police really didn't want to get involved, it was a family issue, it wasn't something that law enforcement necessarily wanted to be involved in, but in the last several decades, that has begun to change. It's considered a crime, not a family problem, so Karen, what's been the impact of that change to our approach toward domestic violence?
Well, our approach is much broader now, whereas I started doing this work about 25 years ago, and I can remember it was very shelter-based. It was very domestic violence program-based, and over the years, we've realized the importance of building collaborations with all of the different community partners, the police, the DAs, everyone, medical providers, because we know that victims are not just going to come to a domestic violence program, that they come up, they reach out for help in all the different parts of our community, so everyone has to be aware of the issue and then know what to do to get help for people.
Has your exposure of over 25 years of doing this, what's been the fundamental change? Are you seeing more people come in, different kinds of cries for help? Is there more help available?
There is more help available. I think that that's one thing that has changed over time. The collaborations have grown and changed over time. The thing that hasn't changed is that it is still happening across all the different sectors of the community.
And nationwide, Ruth Glenn, has the approach changed in every community in America? Is it no longer something that law enforcement ignores everywhere? Or are there still pockets where people just don't want to get involved?
You know, I agree with Karen. For the most part, the collaborative efforts that have taken place in communities has really been helpful. It's raised awareness. Entities are training each other about the issues of domestic violence. But I also agree with you, Mike, that we definitely have pockets in this nation And I won't point them out, but we have pockets in this nation that still have not gotten the training, the education, or awareness that they need to address domestic violence appropriately.
This is one of the more dangerous calls that police officers have to respond to because it's a very volatile situation, a very emotional situation that they're stepping into. What is the department's approach when they go out on one of these calls, Sergeant?
Well, as you've said, you know, we're dealing with very real, raw human emotion when officers are called to step into these situations. And whether the parties involved call us or, which is more often the case, a third party, so a neighbor, a witness, someone else who becomes aware of the situation. So we spend a tremendous amount of time training our officers how to respond to these calls, starting with the 911 call itself. So our dispatchers are trained on very specific questions to ask. For instance, are there any weapons in use? Are there weapons in the home? Who else is in the home? A lot of questions so that even in the process of responding prior to arriving, officers have information that they can use to better keep themselves safe as well as the folks there. So once there, the initial every effort is made to simply ensure safety.
Sergeant Varnum told Creative Loafing, Karen, that domestic violence crimes are one of the most, if not the most, underreported crimes. Do you understand why?
Yeah, I think because a lot of victims feel like they are not going to be believed first, and then when they do reach out for
Why would they not be believed?
Because that's what the perpetrator is telling them, is that no one's going to believe you, that you're worthless. They do so much to try and put the victim in a place where they feel isolated, and that's really where domestic violence thrives, is in isolation. And so when that happens, victims, it's difficult for them to reach out. Then on top of that, though, if they do reach out and then they don't get a positive response, if they don't get a supportive response, then they're likely to go back and start keeping that secret again. And so it's so important when a victim reaches out that that very, very first response is a positive one and a caring one for a victim, because otherwise it's just going to reinforce what the perpetrator has told them.
And it used to be, Ruth, that women would not report domestic violence, and they are the primary victims of this, although there are men who are victims of domestic violence, but women didn't report it historically because they had no options. If the guy left, they had no way to support themselves or their children. Is that still the case in many cases?
Yes, I appreciate you referencing that women are most commonly victims because of our enculturated response to domestic violence in this nation. But yes, that is only one of the many reasons that could be present for a victim to come forward and or get the services and support that they need. It could be financial, it could be related to family support and not having any, or not having the appropriate friends and family support. It could be related to a job. If a victim feels like they would not have a job or the support of their workplace, then it certainly puts up another barrier for them leaving. We too often ask victims to leave without understanding that they have these many and various barriers. When the National Coalition would prefer that we talk about perpetrators and why they hurt.
If I read the statistics right, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Sergeant, in Charlotte, the rate of domestic violence, as far as we know, has remained steady, and yet the homicides resulting from domestic violence have risen. Is that correct?
That is correct. But again, the overall percentage of homicides in 2017 that had a DV origin, that relationship as it relates to the overall homicide rate was slightly higher, but not overly higher. So in other words, the number of DV homicides was increasing, kind of consistent with the overall homicide
rate. Ruth, you were responding to that. I guess this is happening around the country. The domestic violence is the death.
Say something about that. We are seeing an increase nationally of lethal homicides related to domestic violence. We have several theories, the one being that because of awareness and because we are really becoming more educated and understanding domestic violence, abusers are being held more accountable, and we firmly believe that their choices in regards to committing something lethal, such as murder, or committing a lethal act, is sometimes what they feel is their only choices as a perpetrator of domestic violence. So nationally, we are seeing an increase.
I want to get back to the fact that women used to have no options at all, but more women are in the workplace than ever before. I mean, they're 51% of the population. There are a lot of people working, a lot of women working. Has that changed the equation, Karen, in any way?
Well, I think it has changed some for some people. So I think there are a lot of women out there. We serve a number of women who are executives who, you know, work for some of the top companies in Charlotte. And they may come in and they may just need a protective order. They may have the dollars that they need to go and get an apartment, or they may be able to live with family members. But you've also got people who are living in intergenerational poverty. You've got people who are dealing with racism and other barriers. And the options for them are very, very limited. And so we've got to look at all of these folks.
So, Ruth, your organization, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, has been working for years, as has Safe Alliance Charlotte, to make domestic violence unacceptable. And you've been working on policy, according to your website. A policy approach is to create a society in which domestic violence is never tolerated or minimized, in which victims and survivors are respected, and in which service providers have the resources to serve all victims and survivors. How would you assess your success in those efforts?
You know, I think we have been successful in most areas, you know, particularly around policy and particularly around programs that allow for support to survivors. We have, you know, I'm speaking to what Karen was speaking to. We have financial education webinars which we provide to survivors to help them understand their finances and how they can be successful after having separated. We work really hard on policy. Over the years, the Violence Against Women Act has been implemented and continues to get reauthorized with some challenges. So those are some of the examples that we use, and particularly around the training. I appreciate the remarks about training and education. VAWA has been instrumental in ensuring that law enforcement gets the appropriate training that they need to respond to domestic violence.
The first four homicides of 2018 in Charlotte, Isaiah Miller, Elia Miller, James Hawkins, Brittany White, two young children, a law enforcement officer, and a mother, all result of domestic violence. Is this just a coincidence or an indication that the problem of domestic violence is growing?
I think it just underscores the scale of the problem that many of the folks, like Karen and everyone that's been working in this business for years and years has known, that domestic violence relationships and the particularly chronic abuse situations always carry with them the potential to result in tragedy on that scale. And I think it underscores the need for us to move forward with new initiatives to kind of reevaluate what we're doing, how we're doing it, how we bring the best possible service to our victims to keep them safe, how to hold abusers more accountable to keep tragedies like this from continuing.
And in speaking about those four victims, Kerr Putney, the chief, pleaded with other victims to please give us the opportunity to save your life. Safe Alliance Charlotte helps people do just that. Are people not coming to you? Is that a plea out of necessity because people are not coming forward? And I have about 30 seconds.
People do come forward, but I think Chief Putney was saying that as a situation is escalating, we need you to call the police. We need to make sure that you are reaching out for help.
Okay. Karen Parker, CEO of Safe Alliance Charlotte. Sergeant Craig Varnum is also with us, supervisor at CMPD's Domestic Violence Unit. And Ruth Glenn, president and CEO of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. When we come back, we'll take a look at options for help and new approaches that law enforcement is taking. We'll hear from one of the district attorneys about that in a moment. Meet Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sherpa, offering recruiting and consulting services in finance, technology, and project management. Details at SherpaLLC.com. And Duke Energy, investing in technology designed to modernize the Carolinas energy grid over the next 10 years. More at Duke-Energy.com/future. Why the Queen City didn't make the shortlist to be the location of Amazon's second headquarters. You could probably hear it all over town, the gnashing of teeth, the renting of garments over this issue. Well, we'll take a look at that as best as we can, given that details are sketchy at best. Some public officials are calling for the details of our proposal to be made public so we could learn maybe something from whatever went wrong. We're going to hear from one of those officials, handicap Raleigh's chances, and discuss what we need to do better to attract top companies next time, tomorrow, on this program at 9.
I'm John Harwood. Coming up on the next On Point, the Trump administration turns one. We'll take stock of the president's first year at home and abroad. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for that conversation on Point at 10 o'clock following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about domestic violence and where people go for help and why they should go for help and encouraging them to go for help, et cetera, this morning. I mentioned at the very beginning of the hour that Mecklenburg County's District Attorney Spencer Merriweather has characterized Charlotte's domestic violence problem as an epidemic. And to hear him tell it, it's worse than that.
Domestic violence is indeed an epidemic. And what that means is that our community is sick. We are suffering from something. In terms of domestic violence, we are a community that needs treatment.
Charlotte is sick and in need of treatment. That from a criminal justice professional who sees the end result of this every single day. Donna Rainwater also witnesses the results every day. She is the supervising attorney in the DA's office, Special Victims Unit, and she joins us for the remainder of the hour, along with our previous guest, Sergeant Craig Varnum from CMPD's Domestic Violence Unit, Karen Parker, CEO of Safe Alliance Charlotte, and Ruth Glenn, President and CEO of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Donna Rainwater, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sitting there very quietly, pull that microphone toward you a little bit.
Okay.
You've sunk into your chair and gotten comfortable. Don't get too comfortable. Here come the questions. it is uncomfortable to hear that the district attorney's office would characterize our city as being sick and in need of treatment when it comes to domestic violence. Is he saying that all of Charlotte is sick and in need of treatment, or just a particular part or parts of the community?
I think it's the entire community.
Really?
We always talk about this being a problem. Domestic violence is a problem with victims. Victims don't want to come forward. Victims don't want to prosecute. And while that is true, it is definitely a community problem. It happens behind closed doors, but that doesn't mean people aren't aware. Sisters, brothers, parents, coworkers, when you see this happening, you've got to get involved. You've got to help. When you call police, you've got to be willing to give a statement. You got to come to court and testify when you're needed. It truly is a community issue.
What's the root cause of the problem? Is it people not wanting to come forward? Or if we're sick, if this is happening, if these incidents, if this violence is being perpetrated, do we understand the root cause of it?
Well, if you think about it, it's similar to, you know, stranger danger. You'd be afraid of the stranger, and you come to court and testify about them, but that's not the case with family violence. The people who are perpetrating these crimes, they're doing it to people they love, people they're close to. So victims, they're torn. They don't like the way they're being treated, but many times they love their abuser. So it's a very difficult situation to deal with. Service providers, advocates, they have a difficult time. But even beyond that, we've got to get people to come to court. They've got to cooperate. If we want to hold any abuser accountable, we've got to have the cooperation of the victims and the community.
Has it gotten worse, gotten better, or are you just simply more aware of the problem than you were 10 years ago or 5 years ago?
Well, it's interesting. When I started more than 10 years ago, I did start in our domestic violence courtroom in district court. The same issues that I saw 11, 12 years ago, they're the same issues we deal with today. What we can do a better job of, and the people sitting around this table, we've talked about the Family Justice Center, it really has to be a collaboration. We have to build better cases so we can hold abusers accountable. Building a better case means not resting the entire prosecution on the shoulders of a victim. We've got to have evidence-based prosecutions. Mm-hmm. We've got to find documentation, photographs, other witnesses. We've got to find other ways to build a case without it resting completely on a victim of a crime.
Ruth Glenn, you want to chime in on that?
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that, Donna. I think one of the issues in previous years, and we are seeing some advancement in that, is, you know, previously we asked the victim to take pretty much charge of this issue. They've got to come forward. They've got to cooperate. But when you allow a community to get behind that victim and offer her real good support, then the chances of holding abuser accountable are increased.
Yes.
And so I appreciate Donna saying that.
But we're going to talk a lot about the realization on the part of the DA's office and I guess law enforcement in general about what needs to happen to be more supportive and to make this make the outcomes better as we go through the program here. But, Sergeant, we just heard, I read a quote from your boss, Chief Kerr Putney, about please give us the opportunity to save your life, a plea to victims and potential victims. And you've said that the resources for victims are there, but getting people to use them is the challenge. Why?
That is very much accurate. So we've done a lot of analysis of, and again, we've got amazing people, particularly in this community, that have been doing amazing work with victims and offering victim services as well as abuser services. We have two abuser education programs in our community, NOVA, which is a court-ordered program, and a private organization, Impact, that provide education for abusers. The issue that we've started to find and the issue that we've shed more light on as we work with a nationwide organization known as the Alliance for Hope International is that these resources exist, but they exist in sort of a silo type of a model to where those resources are spread out. They're not all in the same place, and they can become incredibly difficult and nearly impossible for a victim to manage, particularly in the context of trying to manage those resources in the wake of what may have been the most traumatic event of their entire life.
And the DA's office has recognized that. We're going to talk in a second about one thing that they're trying to do to bring all those resources together. This month, a local woman, Christina Treadway, committed suicide after killing her two children. Christina's mother, Patricia Treadway, told NBC Charlotte that her daughter was in an abusive relationship and looking for a way out.
She was going to leave on Sunday and come here. We were going to get her a plane ticket for her and the kids to move here to be with us. She told her that you're not leaving. You're not leaving with these kids.
So do we know if she had sought help in that situation locally? Do we have any idea?
Mike, I can tell you that we don't have any recorded reports involving those folks.
Okay.
And that's about all I could comment on that
So
case.
Once a victim steps forward, is the problem that the process of taking out protective orders and following through with filing charges, it's lengthy and it's one in which the victim doesn't feel very safe while all of that is going on? Is that part of the problem here?
Yeah, I think so. We see a lot of victims who we talk to and we will get them started in the process, but it's very difficult when you are having to go to a lot of different places to receive the services. And meanwhile, you may have two kids that are tagging along with you. You may be missing work because you're having to do this. And it's not a process right now where you can go to one place for 1 or 2 days and get all of the services. To access all of the services that a person might need right now could take weeks or even a month to go around to every single different location. And that's really the challenge. We've got a lot of great service providers and organizations that want to help, but it's difficult to get the victims to the places that they need to go.
Is the same true across the country, Ruth?
Yes, and I'd like to even expand that further. Thank you for that, Karen, which is you are attempting as a victim to do all of that, but also maybe in deathly fear that every corner you turn or every service that you go to, particularly if you go to your job, let's say you go to your job, that perpetrator is there. You know, protection orders and getting the services that you need sounds really simple unless you are in fear for your life.
Mm. When Spencer Merriweather, our new district attorney, was on this program, I think in December, one of the things we spoke about was finding a way to bring resources together in a way that makes navigating the system easier for the victims that need the help. And one of the things he mentioned was setting up a special victims unit, of which you are the special supervising attorney for this, Donna. How long have you been in that position? How long has that unit been operational? What are you focusing on?
Well,
Where to begin?
So Spencer, he created the Special Victims Unit, I guess, in December.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning of the year, we were up and running. So we had separate units. We had violent crimes, which the adult rape and child sexual abuse prosecutors were a part of. And then we had domestic violence. We have long recognized that many of those issues are similar. You do have special victims. They have similar issues. So what he did in creating that team, we have made basically a family violence unit. It's adult and child sexual abuse and domestic violence, and it's made up of experienced prosecutors who are experienced in handling felonies.
So how does that help the victims?
Well, one, when you go to court, there's a big difference between misdemeanors and felonies. A lot of the domestic violence cases we have, the majority of those are in district court, and they're handled as misdemeanors.
Give me an example. What would be a domestic violence incident that would qualify to be a misdemeanor?
An assault on a female, and I think that's the typical charge. Assault on a female, you get punched by your significant other, maybe you have a black eye. That's considered a misdemeanor in North Carolina.
Okay.
Approximately 100,000 misdemeanors go through our misdemeanor court system every year. So there's a lot of those. We have a special domestic violence courtroom. So even in district court, when people are charged with a misdemeanor, you have prosecutors who are trained in domestic violence issues. They have smaller dockets, so they're able to focus on those cases a little differently than, say, your standard misdemeanor. The difference with a felony prosecution, you have a little more time. You can work with detectives, and when you're building a felony case, you've really got to work through the evidence and get it ready to take in front of a jury instead of a judge.
What's a felony case in domestic violence parlance?
We get a lot of different types. It could be assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, people shooting into their significant other's houses, and obviously strangulation. One of the crimes we've been talking about a lot lately, that is a felony in North Carolina.
And we are going to talk about that as we go through the program. Mr. Merriweather's intention back in December was to have this unit fully up and operational in 6 months. Where do you stand? Give us a progress report.
Well, we are up and operational. We're still making efforts to combine. We've got to combine trial court calendars, our administrative courts. So there's a lot of things we're doing with the court system and within our own office.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as handling cases, we're up and running. We've got experienced prosecutors, and they're still doing what they've been doing every day, even before this change was made.
CMPD has also announced that they will be partnering with your organization, Karen, Safe Alliance, and others to open a family justice center. Where do we stand with that, and what will that do?
Well, we're at the very beginning stages. We are in the planning phase right now. This was a decision that was made around November, December, where a lot of us got together and we went to a conference and learned a lot about family justice centers and recognized that this is something that Charlotte needs to do. Mm-hmm. And we're really in a great situation right now because we have the leadership. All of the leaders are in the right place at the right time. They're all completely supporting this initiative. You heard from Spencer Merriweather and Chief Putney, and we are all coming together to create what really is a one-stop shop for mm-hmm. victims of domestic violence.
How will it work? I guess that's the question. I mean, we've talked a little bit what happens now, the Byzantine labyrinth that people have to navigate to get help and the time it takes to do that. And if you have kids and you have to work and you're dealing with domestic violence at the same time, that can be prohibitive. So how will this work?
Yes, what we want to create is a one-stop shop where people can come when they are a victim of domestic violence. They will meet with an advocate like they would do at our organization, but we will also have the police there. We'll have the DA's office there. We'll have medical providers there and a myriad of service providers. The county social services will be there so that we are all working together and collaborating on the services for this victim.
So right now, before this unit goes into full operation, people come to you or they come to the police department. and you help? I mean, how do you help? How does your organization help? What do you do for these
people? They come into the system a lot of different ways, but at Safe Alliance, we take calls on our hotline. Police will bring victims to us. We operate a 24/7 domestic violence shelter, and we serve about 120, typically women and children, every night. And we also offer victim assistance services. So we have staff who are over at the courthouse, both advocates and attorneys, who work with people to get protective orders.
So does the Family Justice Center, when it's up and running, will this take the process from whatever it is now, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of dealing with people and finding where to go next, to one day, to 24 hours, to 3 days? How will it reduce the time?
Yeah, it's going to reduce it significantly. And every victim is different. Every victim is reaching out for different services. And it really is up to each person to determine which services they want to access. But we know that it's going to reduce a lot of the time that is spent. And they're going to be in one safe location that is trauma-informed, that's child-friendly. So it's really going to be a much warmer and much more responsive experience for people.
So this is the Family Justice Center. And then we have the Domestic Violence Special Victims Unit, essentially. Do the two work together? Is that the plan, that the two will come together?
Absolutely.
How?
Well, we're sort of doing this now with our child abuse cases. So the Pats Place Child Advocacy Center here in Mecklenburg County, they're already co-located with Levine's Children's Hospital Pediatric Resource Center. So every week, our lawyers are over there having meetings, talking about cases. We work as a multidisciplinary team. So we're already doing that with those types of cases. What the Family Justice Center will do is incorporate more agencies into that, and we'll loop in the entire family, adult victims of violence, children, loop it all in, so continuing the good work that we've been doing.
Maybe it's my own internal filter that's coming into play here, but usually when we talk about domestic violence, the first thing we think of is the husband beating the wife. How many children are involved in this? How many children are victims of domestic violence, are injured through domestic violence?
Well, there are many children. I can tell you, any day that you walk into our domestic violence shelter, I just said we have 120 people staying there, 60 to 70 of those are going to be children who have come with an adult victim.
And they've been hurt in what way?
They've witnessed the domestic violence. In some cases, they have been victims themselves, but they have always witnessed it.
And Mike, I'd like to just comment on that quickly. Mm-hmm. There is a report that identifies that 80%, I think it's 80% of children that are in a home where domestic violence is present are often suffering direct child abuse. So we make a fine definition about that, which is that the abuser may be committing domestic violence in this home, but then he may also, or she may also, be committing direct child abuse against the child.
Hmm. This Family Justice Center is a new idea for Charlotte. Is this a new idea in other parts of the country? Do you know where it works particularly well, if it's in operation or something like it is in operation, Ruth?
San Diego has the best model. We also are very aware, and I'd like to be clear about this. It sounds like Charlotte is working really hard at making sure that this Justice Center is put together thoughtfully and critically, and all of the partners are appropriately on board. But for the most part, the Family Justice Centers are really the best way to go and responding wonderfully. San Diego has the best model, and the Alliance entity that Karen was speaking of is really the leader in that. So they are assisting communities in putting these justice centers together.
I have 30 seconds. What makes San Diego's the best?
Well, it was the premier. It was the first model. And it has worked over the years to, quote-unquote, refine that model to make sure that it's victim-centered, that it's trauma-informed, that all of the parties coming to the table understand the dynamics of domestic violence.
Ruth Glenn is president and CEO of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We're going to continue our conversation and talk about something else you never hear about, and that is strangulation, in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Regional Partnership, which markets the 16-county, two-state region known as Charlotte USA to companies looking to expand or relocate in our market. Information about supporting the effort at charlotteusa.com. And the J.E. Broyhill Civic Center, presenting the American Spiritual Ensemble, classically trained vocalists offering spiritual jazz and Broadway songs on January 25th. Details and tickets at broyhillcenter.com. CNN.com. The Trump presidency begins its second year this week with a government shutdown. A look at the chaotic first year of the Trump White House at home and abroad, and what the week ahead may portend as the shutdown is questionable, I suppose, with guest host Jane Clayson. She'll be sitting in during On Point coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. On WFAE, we will continue our conversation about the impact of domestic violence and where people go for help in a moment.
Whether you're reflecting back on 2017 or looking ahead into the new year, big stories, they're everywhere.
The standard deduction nearly doubled.
Kim warned the U.S. that its mainland is within
allegations of sexual harassment.
So when you just need to get caught up or you want to dig deep, count on Morning Edition for the latest updates with the background that puts it all in perspective for you. Listen every day.
Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about domestic violence and the steps Mecklenburg County is taking to make it easier to navigate the system for victims to get help through both the Family Justice Center that's being established and through CMPD, and also the Special Victims Unit being put together by the DA here. And we have people from all these places with us. Sergeant Craig Varnum is supervisor of CMPD's Domestic Violence Unit. Donna Rainwater is the supervising attorney in the District Attorney's Office with the Special Victims Unit there. Karen Parker is CEO of Safe Alliance Charlotte, which is helping to put together this Family Justice Center with CMPD. And Ruth Glenn is president and CEO of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Do the services that are out there for victims, are there also services out there for abusers? Counseling services for them to understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, and to change their behavior, Sergeant?
Absolutely, because without that, honestly...
Forced into that?
Well, they can be. They can certainly be court-ordered to attend a abuser education program. The court-ordered program here that's sponsored through Mecklenburg County Community Support Services is called the NOVA program, and that stands for New Options for Violent Actions. So it literally is a program that attempts to work with abusers and show them what abuse looks like, because again, and I'll touch back on what some of what everyone, what Donna and Ruth and Karen have already mentioned, in that really, and we keep coming back to the Family Justice Center model, but what's been realized over the years through the research and has been verified through extensive research conducted not only by the Alliance for Hope International, but multiple other agencies and institutions around the country, all of this interpersonal violence is interconnected. The Family Justice Center will serve not only victims of domestic violence, but sex assault, crimes against children, elder abuse, and all of these other, because at the heart of it, they all intersect and they all come together. And they can all, many of them, trace their lineage to the unmitigated effects of childhood trauma.
How many abusers come forward to ask for help because they are shocked by their own behavior and disappointed by their own behavior and want help?
I will tell you that does happen. I don't know the numbers or statistics for that, but I can tell you that certainly does happen.
How successful are these treatment programs for abusers? Are they successful? Does this end in a good way most times, or is there something fundamentally wrong here that really it can't be corrected?
Well, I think they're probably split down the middle. We certainly know that many abusers, particularly in domestic violence situations, are very skilled manipulators. Mm-hmm. So when they enter a program such as that, they can do what they need to do while they're in the program. They can say what they need to say and look like a model student and graduate, if you will, from said program, and then go back to things as usual. Because we know we see very high rates of recidivism, particularly in domestic violence cases.
When I asked that question, Donna, your eyes kind of gave me the idea that perhaps you're a little skeptical about
I am
that.
A little skeptical. I'm cynical. But look, in our office, we do with first-time offenders, people who don't have lengthy criminal records, anytime there's a probationary sentence, we are requiring offenders to do this program, one of these treatment programs. So we are making the efforts on the front end when people first come into the system to try to get them help. But like the sergeant said, we see a lot of recidivism. We see people come back. And sometimes, you know, the only option is a harsher punishment for these people.
Are you a skeptical, Ruth?
Oh, yes. absolutely skeptical. Our experience nationally is that
perpetrators don't come forward. Our experience nationally is we are in dire need of some type of standard response to perpetrators because it feels as though it's very fragmented and not done very well. And I also agree that perpetrators make choices about this violence. And so some of their choices may be to respond appropriately to those that are holding them accountable just long enough to be able to move through that and go back to their violence.
There's another side to this. It's the reason for putting together this Family Justice Center and the Special Victims Unit in the DA's office is that evidently it's very difficult for victims to navigate, but it's just as difficult for police officers because there's a lot of paperwork evidently involved in domestic violence situations to which they respond. And quite often, because victims don't follow through with getting protective orders or file charges against the people who have perpetrated the violence on them. So police get a little, I guess, dismayed because all their work is for nothing. If they don't file charges, all the paperwork has been done and nothing happens. And you say, Sergeant, that you've seen more failures than success. Will this Family Justice Center help?
Well, certainly the nationwide research tells us that it will. In nearly every community, there are about 120-plus established family justice centers open throughout the country. And in nearly all of them, when communities have done research to look at pre- and post-numbers, they have seen pretty marked improvement in domestic violence conviction rates, significant reduction in overall calls for service. We've come back to the San Diego model again. They pioneered this program over 20 years ago. Over a 7-year period after opening the doors to their Family Justice Center, they saw a 50% reduction in overall calls for service. That is a huge number. If we could come close to that locally, we're talking about going from 40,000 to 20,000 calls for service per year. Obviously, that has marked impact not only on saving lives, but financially. Those calls for service create a cost for the city, and reducing them by 50% would be significant.
We share a comment that has come in on Facebook as we've been talking here. Can you address the help and options that are available to undocumented women who endure domestic violence under the current climate? As we know, the current administration in Washington is a little tough on people who are here illegally, and that has caused fear in the neighborhood to come forward to police and to the court system. What is the situation there?
Well, I can tell you at Safe Alliance, we do provide services to undocumented people. We have always done that as part of the Violence Against Women Act and the federal mandates. We are supposed to be doing this.
But if they go forward and you have to contact the police or they have to get involved with the court system, what does that do given their undocumented status?
Well, more recently, that has been a more difficult thing for us to navigate because we're not sure what's going to happen with every victim. We do try, though, to provide just as much support as possible to that person, and we want to make sure that people know that they can still reach out to us for help because we don't want to see people, we don't want to see another homicide.
Have you noticed a change in the number of people from that community coming forward because of fear?
Yeah, we have seen fewer people coming forward.
Wow.
Definitely.
And that's happening everywhere, right?
Yes.
Yes. Great fear.
Dennis emails, I've heard many times that abused children grow up to be abusers. Is anyone tracking what happens to children who witness spousal abuse? Sergeant.
I will tell you that it's something that the police department has spent a tremendous amount of time, training, education, and research on. We've had a longstanding program called CDCP, which stands for Child Development Community Policing. That rolled out a decade ago as a pilot program. It now exists in every police division within the city, mm-hmm. where we have embedded, trained, trauma-informed child advocate counselors who will actually respond as kind of a mental health first aid responder to begin to mitigate the effects of child witnesses to trauma.
North Carolina 8th District Congressman Richard Hudson, a Republican, sponsored a bill that passed the House in December that would allow many domestic abusers banned from carrying firearms in their home states to obtain concealed carry permits elsewhere. It's called the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act, and opponents say it would allow states with the loosest standards to define the nation's laws and undermine states' rights to protect their own residents. This act wasn't targeted specifically so that domestic abusers could have access to guns, but they could use that to their advantage. Where does this stand? Anybody know where this stands in Congress? It passed the House. Has it gone to the Senate yet?
No. This is Ruth. No, it has not. It is in a holding pattern, for instance. But I must tell you, as the we are very, very concerned about the repercussions of a national effort such as that. There are far too many loopholes in all of our gun laws, particularly background checks and concealed carry reciprocity and others, that allow for domestic abusers to have access to weapons.
Guns certainly play a role in all of this. We see it in the paper all the time. But CMPD has most recently been looking at how domestic violence crimes involve acts of violence like strangulation. There's a big article in the Charlotte Observer this morning about this. Sergeant, you're quoted in it, and you've called domestic violence perpetrators who resort to strangulation ticking time bombs. Why?
Yep. I did. And again, this is drawn on the bulk of the research being conducted by an organization called the Training Institute on Strangulation Prevention. They have done a tremendous amount of research over the years. They began that research in response to two young women who were brutally murdered by strangulation in San Diego, California. And they began to look at that crime, and they found that it was very underreported and misunderstood. Mm. And as they began to dig deeper into that research, they came up with some striking correlations with extremely high numbers of correlation that they didn't really anticipate. They found that men who strangle women are far more likely to ultimately kill their intimate partners. The latest research tells us that that number is as high as 700% more likely for a victim to die at the hands of a man who strangles a woman. And I will say exclusively men who strangle women, because it is nearly a 100% gendered crime.
Why is the incidence so much higher? Because they're willing to use their hands to do it as opposed to a weapon?
Yes. So at the heart of all domestic violence is power and control. And there is no greater act to define power and control than literally holding another human being's life in your hands. We know that most men who strangle women don't ultimately kill their partners by strangling them. They kill them by shooting them. Right. They strangle them to prove to them that they can kill them.
Is this recognized around the country, Ruth?
Yes, I couldn't. I so appreciate Craig's remarks. It is such a power tool. It's such a tool of power to strangle someone. It's very personal. And yes, we are seeing it across the nation. And I just agree with all of his remarks. Yes.
One of the things that you talked about in that article in the paper this morning, in the Observer this morning, Sergeant, is that one of the reasons this is unrecognized or underreported is that people don't understand the term strangulation. They may not connect it to what has happened to them. Explain that.
Absolutely. So we've a lot of this research has been focused on interviewing survivors of this crime, interviewing known victims of other domestic violence situations in service provider settings and shelter settings. And that research has told us that if we ask a room full of 100 known domestic violence victims if they've been strangled, the vast majority of us will say no, because in many people's minds, to be strangled means you're killed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely not the case. In fact, the North Carolina statute on strangulation is similar to most around the country, and I believe, and Ruth, you may comment on this, but I think there are only four states remaining in the nation that have not made the crime of strangulation a felony. But the overall our statute in North Carolina is one of the broadest statutes in that any attempt to restrict blood or airflow qualifies as strangulation. So if someone places their hands around someone else's neck and restricts their blood or their airflow or takes other affirmative steps to do those things, the crime of strangulation has occurred.
And unlike those who pull a trigger or use a knife, you've called these people sociopath predators. Why?
Well, so coming back to those correlations that the Training Institute on Strangulation Prevention found, they found that men who strangle women are far more likely, as we've said, to kill their intimate partners. They're also far more likely to kill other people. Mm. They have found that they are likely some of the most violent human beings on the planet, and they are far more likely to kill police officers. Nationwide studies of jurisdictions that have gone back and reviewed the history of known cop killers, we see numbers between 40 and 60% of men who have killed police officers having a history of strangling women. We also know that many mass murders in recent years, when we look at those folks' history,
have a history
of strangling women.
The man who killed over 20 people in that Texas church recently, the man who ambushed CMPD police officers at the headquarters parking lot a week ago, the man who committed mass murders at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, all had a history of strangulation with a domestic partner, all of them. When the courts look at this, when the district attorney looks at this, murder of your domestic partner is a crime of passion, right? Whether they pull a trigger or use a knife or strangle them. But when you pull a trigger, you could be regret that instantly because it only takes that long to do it. When you're strangling somebody, that takes time.
Correct.
What does that tell you about the perpetrator, and how does law enforcement view that versus a shooting or a knife stabbing?
Well, I would say that not all domestic homicides are crimes of passion. Many, most are not. They are premeditated, they are thought out, and certainly with strangulation, we know how long it takes for somebody to lose consciousness. We know how long it takes and how much pressure you have to put on a victim for them to lose consciousness or lose their lives. So that is definitely an intentional act, not a passionate act.
Correct.
But as far as prosecuting those cases, like I said before, I think all of us at the table recognize that it is a group effort. We cannot rely on a victim. Mm-hmm. Somebody that has happened to may not remember everything correctly. They may not remember the events chronologically. We have to build a case that's independent of this victim. It means training prosecutors, training our patrol officers, our first responders, our medical community. It's going to take a group effort so we can successfully prosecute those cases.
When you cut off blood flow to the brain, even though it's not a successful strangulation, you don't die from it. You're saying that you may not remember clearly the incident because your brain was not capable of remembering during that time period.
Correct.
Blood flow has been cut off. And we also, I guess, should mention that in many cases of these mass murderers, whether they're people going and shooting up the office or whatever, they have committed a domestic violence act shortly before that. So this is a problem that affects not just the victim in that household, but many people around town. We are completely out of time. I want to thank Donna Rainwater with the District Attorney's Office, Ruth Glenn with the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Karen Parker with Safe Alliance Charlotte, and Sergeant Craig Varnum with CMPD.